Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It is the season of giving, and many Americans do. They give to groups and charities of many different stripes. But my guest today, famed philosopher and ethicist Peter Singer, says it's not enough or well-targeted enough. Giving is part of being a moral person, he says, and we can give better, more effectively. This hour on Point, how we give. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How do you give? To what? And what does it mean to you? How do you choose your charities, your causes? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. In a moment, we will talk with famed philosopher Peter Singer. Joining me first from Washington is Stacey Palmer. She is editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Stacey Palmer, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Delighted to be with you, Tom.
So I'm looking at a news story here from just a week ago saying the United States is the world's most generous nation. And this is put out by the Global Index, the 2013 World Giving Index. They put together monetary giving and volunteering and helping strangers, come up with the U.S. as most generous. Last year we were fifth. I don't know how this gets tabulated exactly. But does that make sense to you? Is it a consensus held by all that the U.S. is at the top of global generosity?
Well, it depends on what you're measuring. One of the things that study found was that when it comes to giving money, we're just 13th. And I think Americans have always had this tradition of thinking that we are the most generous in terms of cash giving, but apparently we're not. So when you look at the whole, taking in volunteering and other kinds of things, our willingness to help other people is very strong, but we're not quite as good as we might think we are about giving cash, especially given the hard times that many Americans have faced in this downturn.
And what about those hard times, nearly going on half a dozen years soon that we've had economic downturn, hard times. How has that left the philanthropic community, giving in general? What's the trend?
It's been very flat for most nonprofit organizations. So most groups are really struggling to be able to raise just as much as they did last year, and very few groups are raising as much as they were before the recession. So we're still seeing a lot of building back in terms of donations. And added to that is the fact that many of these charities also depend on government money and have been hit pretty hard by the sequester. So they need more private money, but they don't have it.
Do you see trends over time, Stacey, in the kind of charities or groups that Americans are giving to?
It's not as easy to characterize as you might think, but the very wealthy are giving extremely generously. We track million-dollar gifts or more, and we've seen that there's just been an enormous uptick this year in those kinds of gifts, and that's mostly giving to colleges and hospitals and museums, those very large institutions that get those $20 million, $50 million gifts.
And those individuals have done well in recent years.
They've done very well, and they are giving really generously. It's all the other charities that depend on money from people who are maybe less rich than the very, very rich. They're the ones that are struggling, food banks, other kinds of organizations. And it's not just that they're having trouble raising as much as they did before. They're just seeing increased demand, so they need to raise more to serve more people.
Still, for all that, the bulk of American giving from the numbers I'm looking at here comes not from the rich, but from ordinary folks. I'm looking here at one tabulation says $300 billion given annually to charity, 15% from foundations, foundation grants, 6% from corporations, 70 to 90% give, but you know, most comes from average citizens of moderate income.
That's true, and that's why the contributions that you make this time of year and people are thinking about are extraordinarily important to nonprofit organizations. All those $10 and $15 gifts add up to a lot of money, but still in proportion, it's the very wealthiest who are giving a lot of the money to nonprofit organizations. So it's not all coming from average citizens.
What do you make of this geographic distribution of giving that we often see highlighted? I mean, I'm looking here at a tabulation by state. This is from 2010, the most recent, I guess, where, you know, numbers sort of 1 through 6 or 7 in terms of those who give the largest fraction of their income to charity. Utah, Wyoming, Georgia, Alabama, Maryland, South Carolina, Idaho. What do you hear in that list, Stacey?
One of the things that's really important is that religion is a really big indicator of how much people give. And it's not just how much people give to their congregations, but also once you're involved with religious service, with faith groups, that usually is a great predictor of whether you give to all kinds of causes. And so you can see something like Utah at the top of the list. The Mormon tradition of tithing is one of the reasons that people give so much. So that's why we see very big giving figures in those kinds of states.
How do we tabulate charity giving? I mean, even churches make a distinction between what many churches call mission giving, to be sent out into the world to help feed the poor and all the rest, and administration, you know, covering the cost of the heating bill for the church and the pastor, let's say. But does all that get wrapped into what we call charity giving in the U.S. numbers?
Absolutely. When we look at those figures, about $300 billion donated, that's how much we're all writing in our checks. It's not how much goes to the charitable programs. And one of the hot issues in the charity world has been this topic of how much overhead is the right amount of overhead? How do you make sure that the charity is well run? And do you have to pay people maybe better than folks thought in the past to do a good job and make sure that things are being run really well? Perhaps it's not always a good idea to pay poverty wages to people who are working in the nonprofit world. And so there's been a lot of discussion about what's the right amount of overhead, but how do you know that you don't have abusive charities? One of the very cool things that a group of reporters did this year was to look at the 50 worst charities and say that almost all of the money is going to overhead costs and telemarketing and those kinds of things. And that's certainly not anything anybody wants to be giving to.
And what about the way people give? I mean, we have Black Friday and then Cyber Monday, and now people are talking about Giving Tuesday, I guess the day after Cyber Monday. Is that a big deal? Do you see Americans or a new generation of Americans finding their charitable targets online and just plain giving online?
Absolutely. Giving Tuesday was just in its second year last week, and it more than doubled the amount of giving online from nonprofits that participated. Even the White House was encouraging people to participate in Giving Tuesday. So it really rallied people around this idea of thinking that you can think about donations as much as material gifts. So it was a very big success in terms of just changing the thinking a little bit and reminding people that there are lots of needy folks who could really use a hand.
Stacy Palmer, editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy, joining us today from Washington. Stacy, thank you. Good luck with your work, and thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Joining us now from Princeton, New Jersey, is Peter Singer, eminent philosopher, ethicist, a professor of bioethics at Princeton, where he teaches the university's popular course on practical ethics, author of many big books on ethics, altruism, and more, including The Life You Can Save, Acting Now to End World Poverty. Peter Singer, welcome, and welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be with you again.
Do you find that your students come into class with a fair sort of understanding of what goes on in the world of philanthropy and giving? Do they have a realistic sense of American generosity and its function?
No, I don't think they do. I hope that they leave the class with a more realistic sense of it. But I think that, like most Americans, they come to the class imagining that the United States gives a lot more foreign aid than it really does, and they're surprised to learn how little the U.S. actually gives. And they haven't thought very much, I think, about how to divide up their giving. In particular, they haven't thought very much about questions like how much of it should we be giving domestically as compared with to the global poor. Those are questions that I talk about quite a lot in the class.
What about the fundamental issue of giving and sharing in your student body and maybe in the population at large? Is that a healthy understanding of what's required to be a moral human these days?
I think some of them do see giving as part of what's required to be a moral human, as you put it, or an ethically decent person. Mm-hmm. But they tend to think of it as rather small amounts that are required. And I try to point out to them that it's not that difficult to give significantly more, and that not while they're students, but that they're likely to have incomes that are well above average. And I ask them to think about what their responsibilities might be as to what to do with, a more significant portion of that than just sending $100 here or there, but rather thinking about some percentage of that income that they might put aside for giving.
What's the fundamental philosopher's argument for why that giving is important?
I ask them to imagine that they're walking across a park and there's a shallow pond in that park, and they notice as they go through the park that there's something splashing around in the pond. And when they look more closely, they see it's a small child, a toddler, who's fallen in the pond. And of course, their first thought would be, so who's looking after this child? Where are the parents or the babysitter? But they look around, there's nobody there except them and the child. And their second thought probably is, well, I need to save that child. That child looks like it could drown. But then they think, if I jump into the pond, I'm going to ruin my expensive clothes that I'm wearing. That's going to cost me some hundreds of dollars to replace. And I ask them at that point, so if you did have that thought and then you decided you were going to forget about that child because the child's not your responsibility. You didn't put the child in the pond. Nobody asked you to look after the child. So why incur a cost of some hundreds of dollars to save the life of a stranger? I asked them what they would think about that, you know, whether they would think that or what they would think about somebody who did think that. And unanimously, virtually, they say that would be horrific. So I then ask them to compare that with the situation of their ability to help somebody in extreme poverty in one of the developing countries of the world.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point, and we're talking this hour about giving, charity, why we give, where we give, and where giving may have the biggest impact. Peter Singer is with us, philosopher and ethicist, joins us from Princeton, New Jersey. He teaches at Princeton University, a very popular course there among young Americans, trying to think through this issue. Of course, a lot of us just operate kind of at a gut level here. And, hey, if that gets you to give and share, that may not be a bad way either, I suppose. Peter Singer, it's interesting, lots of response already, people sort of, you know, laying down what they do, how they give. Rose says, she lists hers, you know, St. Jude's Children's Hospital, Ronald McDonald's House, ASPCA. She says, because kids should be helped regardless of finances and animals need help to stay healthy. Judy says, I give to the Greater Chicago Food Depository, to New Leash on Life for Pets, to Stewards of the Coast and Redwoods because Redwoods feed my soul. And Daphne says, I give directly to people I know, friends down on their luck, or directly to a family. I don't trust organizations anymore with funds, as many take more for themselves than to help others. I mean, that's just a sampling. How do you encourage your students to start thinking about where to target their giving?
Well, that's an interesting sample because I think every one of those charities that people mentioned is a domestic U.S. charity, either for humans in the U.S. or for animals in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And I certainly do think that animal welfare is a worthwhile cause, of course. All the friends you have will be Americans. And one of the things I get my students to think about is essentially where do you get the biggest bang for your buck? And I think the answer to that is very clearly that you get it by giving to people living in extreme poverty elsewhere in the world, not in the United States. And the reason for that is quite simple. There are about 1 billion people in the world living on what the World Bank describes as extreme poverty, which essentially we could say roughly is less than $2 US a day. Mm. So there's people living on about $700 a year. And, you know, think about, say, giving $100 to somebody who's living on $700 a year. You've made a significant difference to their income. Or perhaps, you know, you can give and you can provide them with a bed net that will protect their child against malaria so the child won't die. Or perhaps, again, for something like maybe $50, you can restore sight to somebody who is blind because of a cataract or prevent somebody getting trachoma, which causes blindness. Now, you can't do that in the United States. For one thing, people who are poor in the United States are probably on $20,000-something a year. That's the poverty line for a family, around $23,000. And $100 isn't going to make a really significant difference to them. And if they're blind because they have cataracts, well, either they can afford the cost of treatment or they've got health insurance, or if they're really poor, they can get it through Medicaid, or if they're old, they can get it through Medicare. You know, they don't need bed nets against malaria. They don't need safe drinking water. They have sanitation. So really, I think the need is much greater, and the difference in the impact that a relatively modest donation can have is so much greater in these developing countries that we should give to the charities that have been demonstrated to be highly effective, the ones that really can show transparently that what they're doing is getting to the people who need it and is doing the greatest possible good.
You know, I get that as a kind of mathematical equation of where $1 will produce the most impact. I absolutely understand what you're saying. And yet, isn't there some kind of moral issue in sort of stepping past or right by or over the person next door to give afar? There's an emotional, at the very least, attachment to those who are nearer. And you're kind of saying, well, look past their suffering. It's relatively modest. It may not feel that way or look that way.
Yes, I suppose I am saying that. And I agree. I feel the emotional pull of people are close. I mean, you see it particularly, of course, if there's a homeless person in the street that you pass and they have a sign up saying, you know, that they're hungry or something like that. But I do step past them because I know that I can't really do much. I mean, perhaps if I have something with me, some food, I might give them some food. But I'm doubtful whether giving them money is actually really going to help their situation because I don't know what their problems are, and it may well not be that. So I think that we really should be not discriminating in favor of fellow citizens because they're close to us or because they are citizens of the same country. I really think that we should be thinking about where the need is greatest, that all, you know, human beings have the same needs. For that matter, animals have needs too, but we should be trying to help those in the greatest need. And I just think that the difference that you can make with those effective charities, as I said, that are working in the developing countries, does overwhelm the feeling that you might have that you want to help people who are closer to you.
Yeah, interesting. That takes a kind of ethical toughness I'm not sure I have. That's not to doubt the need abroad or discourage giving abroad at all. At the same time, there's something in grappling with the need right around us, even if it's on a different scale. Peter Singer is with us, philosopher and ethicist from Princeton University. We've got lots of callers for you, Peter, from Baltimore, Maryland. Jennifer is calling. Hi, Jennifer. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
So how do you give?
Why do we give? We give because we definitely know there is a need. My husband and I have grappled with this for years. We've been married 6 years now, and I would say in the last 4 years, we have given more avidly, but we have found that we are only comfortable giving to very local groups that we know how they operate, we can trust them, we know that there isn't crazy amounts of money going overhead. And my question is, you know, we find ourselves giving, I would say, a lot for our family. He's in school, I work full time, and I would say this year we gave upwards of $1,500, but it was only to local animal rescues and veteran support.
Okay.
When it comes to giving to these very large problems, like the needs of children and homeless, people that we can't see, organizations necessarily that we don't know who runs them, we try to turn to things like Charity Navigator, but we find ourselves very conflicted because we feel like we're trying to make up for a problem that's created by governments and broken systems. And I'm just curious what you think about that.
Several interesting things there. Jennifer, thank you so much for that. That's really great. Let's just start with the sum, $1,500. When the husband's in school, and it feels like a lot. The 6 years married, so, you know, a relatively young couple. We don't have an absolute income there, but when you hear that number, Peter, and you're looking at a first world citizen in Baltimore in the United States, does that meet your standard of what's a sufficient level of generosity?
As you say, we don't know Jennifer's income, but it certainly might do that. If people want to look at my standard in more detail, I have a website called The Life You Can Save. So if you go to thelifeyoucansave.org and you can click on various things, but there is a scale that suggests percentages that people might donate.
Give us a sense of those percentages that you recommend.
Okay, so if 90% of Americans earn less than $105,000 a year, mm-hmm. that figure is might be a year or two old, but it's pretty close. So for those, I'm suggesting giving 1% or somewhere between 1% and 5% of what you earn. So Jennifer may well be in that category, and that might be – that $1,500 might well be somewhere in that range between 1% and 5% of what she and mm-hmm. her partner earn.
Yep.
If you're in the top 10%, then it starts to rise. So for over $105,000 a year, I'm suggesting between 5% and 10% up to $148,000, and then it's a progressive scale that increases as you – as your earnings increase.
And your idea there is that the higher it goes, the less you actually need to live, so the more you should be chipping out for others.
That's right. That's right. I mean, the scale is worked out so that if you earn more, you still get to keep more, but you can certainly give more. The other thing I wanted to say about what Jennifer said, she said mentioned going to Charity Navigator, and she's worried about overheads and so on.
No, that's what we should explain. That's an online service that assesses what overhead and effectiveness of different charities.
Yes, that's right. But it really about the only information that you can get, at least at this stage, though I know they're working on developing more, does relate to the percentage of overheads, and that's not always a good guide. Because as you can easily imagine, an organization might cut back its staff to reduce its overheads and mm-hmm. it will then look better on the Charity Navigator site.
Yep.
But that might mean it doesn't have staff to follow up the grants that are given and to really check that they are doing what is good. And it might have all this money that's listed as program grants, but in fact it might be doing no good at all. Whereas another organization might have, let's say, twice as much administrative costs, mm-hmm. maybe 20% rather than 10%, mm-hmm. but it actually does a lot more good with the money that goes.
How does one figure that out then?
Well, there's another website called GiveWell, givewell.org, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. that actually does much more in-depth research on charities. And it's very, very rigorous and very selective. A lot of people think that it's actually too rigorous because it recommends a very small number of charities. It's currently recommending 3 charities. But it goes into a lot of depth. It has a research team that checks up what's actually happening. It looks at studies that what is being done. For example, earlier I mentioned giving out bed nets against malaria. It checks that that is effective in reducing malaria, that it's effective in saving lives. It checks that organizations are transparent.
Wow, so deep. But 3 charities in the world it recommends?
That's what it's doing at the moment.
Wow.
Now, as I said, a lot of
it's people, a high bar.
It is a high bar. And on the website I am involved with, thelifeyoucansave.org, mm. we actually have a top 10, so we're broader than that. But I have to admit that we draw on GiveWell's research, and our screen is not quite as rigorous as GiveWell's. So if you wanted to be absolutely sure that it had been fully screened, you could go to GiveWell. Otherwise, you can go to The Life You Can Save and give to one of those top 10.
And what about Jennifer's screen, along with her husband? Theirs is going to Animal Rescue and Veteran Support. It's going local. They want to understand what's happening with it. They don't want to send it where they don't have a sense of that. And her observation that they don't want to put their money toward things that are the result of a systemic issue that it sort of sounds like government should be handling or somebody else should be, a properly running society should be taking care of without their charity being the crutch for it. What about that filter?
So I think that there are problems with governments, and I wasn't quite sure what Jennifer was referring to. I mean, in some cases, you might say in some developing countries, there are bad governments, and that's part of the problem. And I agree. And I certainly don't think we should be giving money to those governments, and the organizations that the LifeYouCanSave.org recommends will never give money to the governments, nor will the GiveWell ones. But I think it's tough that people in a country have to suffer because their governments are bad. And I do think that if we can help them to you know, get better health care or sanitation or something like that, then we still ought to be doing that. So I don't have quite the views about government that Jennifer expressed.
Mike is calling from Salem, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. It is an honor to be able to speak with Professor Singer. Professor Singer, I've long kind of struggled with the very good rationale that you give with the person in the suit example about the need to give in faraway places.
With the child in the pond, and do you jump in or not? Yep.
Yeah. I'm wondering how you would respond to the argument that, you know, one should give locally before one gives far away, with the following dilemma, which I'm sure you're familiar with. If you have a person, a parent who is out swimming in a lake, there are two children out with the person swimming, you, yourself. They are both equidistant from you, and they're both drowning. One is your child. Who do you save? And most people would say one would save one's child. I'm wondering if you feel as though that's an argument that says we have to, all things considered, take care of our own first, if there's a need, before we go and go away and try to give to others faraway places. I wonder what your thoughts are about that.
Peter Singer.
Thank you. I'm sure I would save my child, of course. And I think it's reasonable to say that, you know, yes, we have responsibility for our own children and our immediate family if they're in a life-threatening situation. But I think that's very different from questions about where we are already providing quite adequately for our children. Fortunately, they're not in desperate need, and we have some spare resources, money or time, that we can help devote to helping to others. And I don't think you can generalize from the responsibilities we have for our immediate children or immediate family to just others in our larger community or in our nation.
But I think Mike is using that as a metaphor for fellow citizens. But you're not willing to make that jump?
I guess I'm not willing to accept that metaphor. I think the responsibilities we have for our family, where there's very strong emotional ties, are significant. And that is, in a way, the system that we have, that we say parents obviously should look after their children, and it's good for children to look after their parents when they get old and unable to look after themselves and so on. But I don't think that extends just to one's fellow citizens, especially given that we do have a government which, for all of its faults, and there are plenty, does provide Social Security, does provide Medicare and Medicaid, does provide safe drinking water to everybody, some public housing and so on. So I think that American citizens are, by global standards, actually reasonably well looked after.
Still, you can look around in this country and see the need of children who may, yes, they may have food. I don't know the quality exactly. They may have clothes. But there are all kinds of needs that kids have. I mean, you know, maybe it's for attention. I mean, maybe it's for a way to get out of a really tough part of society for a while, to get, you know, on a good track to a better life. I mean, surely you don't mean send a check abroad and sit on your hands when you look around in your own society.
No, I don't. And certainly, if you can give time, and many people can give time, fortunately, and as I think Stacey said at the beginning of the program, that's something that Americans are very good in, volunteering. We're number one in the world in terms of the amount of time we volunteer. Then it's much better to do that locally because, you know, short of flying off to other countries, which is already expensive, and you're not likely to be able to do a whole lot there. So if you're devoting time, I would say yes, work in your local community, see what the needs are, contribute to that. And maybe when you see that, you'll want to put some money into that as well. But I think generally money does go further when given to the people in extreme poverty elsewhere in the world.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about giving, charity, why we give, where we give, and where giving has the biggest impact, with Peter Singer, philosopher and ethicist at Princeton University, author of The Life You Can Save, Acting Now to End World Poverty. Peter Singer joins us from Princeton, New Jersey. And Peter, lots of callers for you. Edna in Chesapeake, Virginia. Edna, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Yes, hi.
Like a lot of people, my family gives 10% to the church, an additional amount to a benevolent fund that helps folks in the community, as well as church members who might be falling on hard times. We're both retired, and so we have a good time volunteering one day a week at a local hospital.
Good.
Good
for you.
Well, it's fun. I'm telling you, it's fun. One day a week, I'm on a local board of the March of Dimes and I volunteer at many of their fundraising events. There's a couple of Sunday school classes at my church that give me what I call seed money. I shop all year round from a local outlet store for gifts for residents of a local nursing home who may not get a new item for Christmas, or they may not even get a visit. Donate to the local WHRO station, PBS. A ladies group I'm in at church, we do one mission action item every year. Every month. It might be a shower for a crisis pregnancy center, blankets and pillows for a halfway house of men coming out of prison. And, of course, there's 12 of those. We do one every month.
Edna, I consider you a paragon just from what you're describing there, myself anyway. But what would you say to Peter Singer's imploring Americans to push more of their giving abroad? Now, you've got a lot of in-kind giving of your time and gifts you find in the secondhand shop and so on. That just sounds great. That 10% that goes to your church, what if Peter Singer said, good as that may be, why don't you send it to an impoverished population abroad? What would your response be, Edna?
Well, in addition to what I give to my church, I would gladly send it to an impoverished nation if I truly believed that the residents who needed that money received it. But no one's ever convinced me of that, so I give where I can see the results.
Bless you, Edna. That's really a beautiful array of things that you're doing there. Peter, it may not exactly fit your formula, but how do you respond to that? Are you so tough you say, oh, Edna, you're misguided?
Well, I think, Edna, it's very interesting what Edna says, because I do think that one of the biggest obstacles for Americans to give overseas is that they're skeptical about whether the money will get to the people who needs it. And I would suggest that Edna should look at those charities that are recommended by thelifeyoucansave.org or by givewell.org, because I do think that we can be very confident there. For example, one of the charities that we're recommending is a charity called Give Directly, and it does guarantee that for every dollar that you give, 90 cents of that dollar will go to a very impoverished family. It's currently working in a rural area of Kenya, and it is giving these families cash grants, just not supporting them because it doesn't want them to be become dependent, but it gives them $1,000 spread over three installments, and it follows what they do with the money. And it sees, for example, that families that live in huts that just have thatched roofs where the rain comes through when it rains heavily and all their belongings get wet and their food might get spoiled because they can't keep it dry, they buy a tin roof. They buy a sheet of metal, which they cannot afford to buy otherwise. And the wealthier families in those villages can have them. So then they can at least keep their stuff dry. And, you know, if you think that you can do that for, I think it costs like a couple of $100s, the difference between staying dry when it rains and being wet is a couple of $100s. I think, you know, I have no doubt there have been independent follow-ups of Give Directly and what they do. I have absolutely no doubt that if you give them $100, $90 of that will get to an extremely poor family that is really much poorer than any American family in your area.
So there's something to really contemplate, to chew on. At the same time, I mean, it's hard to you hear that range of things that Edna's doing, and it just feels so admirable. And not only that, you feel the joy that she takes in that engagement, the joy of engaging with her community rather than sitting apart.
Yeah, and that's important. And I loved what Edna said, actually, when she says about her volunteering one day a week at the local hospital. And you said, that sounds great. And she said, well, it's fun.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people do have that experience.
Yeah.
Yes, being generous is fun. In fact, there's good social science research showing that people who are generous enjoy their lives more. And it does seem that the causation goes at least in that direction, that being generous makes you a more open kind of person who enjoys life more. So I think that's a terrific positive about giving. And I loved what Edna said in all of those respects. And as I said, I think in terms of the time she puts into this, that is something that's much better spent in your local community. But in terms of money that she gives, I hope that she will look at organizations like Give Directly and talk to them about how they can reassure her and make her really believe that 90 cents in every dollar she gives is going to a family in extreme poverty.
Edna, thanks for your call. Meg in Madison, Connecticut. Meg, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm a family practice doctor. I returned on Saturday from spending a week in Haiti, in Lake Ai in Haiti, doing some screening programs in some schools of very impoverished people who are probably living, I think actually the kids are on less than $1, $2 a day.
Is this something you've done before, Meg, or was it a first visit or something?
It's my second visit to Haiti. I've done different kind of clinics, and I speak Spanish, so I've mostly gone to Spanish-speaking countries, but I have a patient who has been working with an Episcopal church, which has started about 5 or 6 rural schools for very little money around Lake Ai. And mm-hmm. she's a health educator and convinced mm-hmm. me to go with her. And it's quite an interesting thing, which comes to the moral question, which I think I know the answer already.
Well, let's hear it.
So while we're at these schools, most of the kids have never seen a doctor except me 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And or when they got their shots when they were a baby, they do have a government shot program. And they don't really have transportation or money, so they don't go to the hospital unless they're literally dying. And so we treat them for things what I would consider very minor, such as allergies, asthma, lice, fungal infections, local infections, burns, mm-hmm. wounds, mm-hmm. and some screening, nothing much. And this costs approximately, well, if you include the airfare and some room and board at the rectory, it costs about $800 for 1 week.
Okay.
Now, for $600, a friend of mine and myself are paying the salary of a health worker to go to the schools when we're not there, $600 each, $1,200 a year, which is every week, although actually we're not that happy with her services.
But you're saying for a full year of service,
costs less than a week.
Yeah. Then, right, but that's less than your one week.
A full year is 1.5 times for a week for me. Now, this person's not a doctor. She's a medical assistant.
Yeah.
So she can only treat a couple little things. But the thing is, I would assume that from the moral point of view, it's probably preferable for me to take this money and give it to Partners in Health or someone like that.
I mean, maybe so, but then again, you don't have the human connection of being there. You don't bring the story back to us. You don't bring that awareness back here. I don't know. Peter, how do you assess that?
Yeah, I do think that what you say is right, Tom, that it is important that Meg can go there and can tell us about it. And even if she was not on NPR, that she would tell other friends, maybe other physicians or other people who have money to spare. I think the role of the eyewitness here, I mean, it goes back to what Edna said, you know, convince me that the people who need the money really get it. Well, Meg can talk to her friends and other people who have money to give and say, look, I can convince you that $1,200 a year can provide a healthcare worker who can visit these kids and who can cure these things that are really quite easy to cure. You know, it's not something like cancer that needs tens of thousands of dollars or anything like that. They're things easy to cure. And I hope that Meg can therefore be an advocate for the kids in Haiti. And you know, she may, as she did now, say every couple of years she makes a visit, and you can't exactly justify the cost of that visit in direct terms, but I think you certainly can justify it indirectly.
You were saying at the top of the show about what Americans give overall in foreign aid and how your students tend to overestimate that. What's your metric there?
Well, there are polls that have been taken over many years in which Americans are asked, as a percentage of government spending, how much do you think of government spending goes on foreign aid? And the most recent poll, the median answer, that is the middle of the extremes, was 28%.
Now, they think that more than a quarter of the federal budget goes to aid abroad?
That's right. Mm. That's right. That's what they think. Now, you know what the real answer is here?
I seem to recall it's a low single digit.
It's about 1%.
Yeah.
It's about so it's a real paradox. You know, a lot of Americans say we think the government gives too much for foreign aid. And but that's because they think, as you say, that a quarter of the government budget goes on foreign aid. And you ask them, well, how much of the government budget do you think should go on foreign aid? And they will say, oh, maybe 10% or 5%. And 5 or 10% is a big multiple of how much is really going on foreign aid in terms of government spending. So on the one hand, they say the government should give less, but when you ask them to name a figure, it's many times higher than what the government is really giving.
Which would leave, in your calculus, plenty of room for individual Americans to give there. Terry in Brewstertown, Tennessee. Terry, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Season's greetings, Tom.
And to you, sir.
I donate the risk of my life and injury, as do many of my fellow volunteer firefighters, volunteer rescue squad members, volunteer medical first responders to save lives and property. I've donated over 10 gallons of my blood, and it infuriates me when I see some millionaire or billionaire getting press for donating a very, very small percentage of their money, most of which they're going to be able to write off on taxes. And I don't see why people can't split their donations like 75% domestic and 25% foreign, because they're doing a whole lot more with the 25% for individuals.
Yeah, and in terms of how far the dollar may go, but you feel like you're putting your life on the line as what, a volunteer firefighter, Terry?
And a volunteer rescue squad member, and yeah. I've been a volunteer medical first responder.
Right.
My union collects and donates toys. We also refurbish toys for children who can't operate them in a normal manner. The American Legion that I'm a member of also collects toys for local children who are doing without.
Terry, I say great to all that. Absolutely great. We'll hear what Peter Singer has to say. I appreciate your call. Peter, how about it? 10 gallons of blood and many, many hours of volunteer time. And there, Terry, you know, plus toys and all the rest, there's the bulk of his giving.
Yes.
Are you going to turn the man's effort away?
No, definitely not. I really admire people who do that, who take risks with their own safety as a volunteer firefighter. I know, because I'm originally from Australia, where we had terrible bushfires, and firefighters do get killed, as indeed, of course, happened in this country over the summer. So I think that's a heroic thing to do, a wonderful thing to do, and I certainly admire that. Blood donate too, I mean, that's easier. I know I've done a lot of blood donating myself, and it's not that inconvenient, but mm-hmm. still, it takes time, and there's that little prick that's not so great. I admire all that. And actually, I also want to mention what Terry said about if people were to give 75% of their donations, their financial donations we're talking about now, domestically, and 25% abroad. I think that would be a big start. I mean, I would still push the figures more towards giving abroad, but unfortunately, Americans don't give anything like a quarter of their charitable giving abroad. And if they would follow Terry's suggestion and do that, we would be seeing a big increase in the amount of money given to the world's most needy. And especially if they were to follow the recommendations of looking at the most effective organizations that we talked about before, then we would really start to see some significant results.
Terry might have come up with a formula for beginning on the Peter Singer path right there. Terry, thank you very much for what you do and for your call. One more right here. Joe in Harpers Ferry, Iowa. Joe, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I'm curious. Should you give to the present or should you give to the future? Example, Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast. Would you have given to the Red Cross or the Nature Conservancy to help mitigate the problems in the future? And I think a good example of this is Heifer International. They offer people animals. If they manage well, they have a future. And I think a lot of it has to do with the donors' ability to appreciate the stability of the organization and the system they're working within.
It's a marvelous question, Joe. Thank you very much for it. Peter, give to the present need right in front of you, the food needed right now, or to the future, to maybe doing something on climate change or, the Nature Conservancy's work on a seashore.
Yeah, I do think that we should be concerned about the future. That's certainly true. It's sometimes very hard in the face of a disaster like the Hurricane Haiyun that we had in the Philippines mm-hmm. to not want to help. But sometimes there's ample a given because of the publicity that these get. And Katrina is a good example. You know, I think there was perhaps more money given in the aftermath of Katrina because it's publicity than really could be well used. It was certainly true of after 9/11, the amount of money that was donated to New York was really more than could be used. So I think we should look at the future. There's an organization, for example, called GeoHazards International that tries to predict where there will be hazards like a tsunami. So, of course, we had the disastrous Asian tsunami a few years back, and people gave a lot of money in the wake of that. But it was pointed out that it was predictable that there would be earthquakes there, and there's a large population living at sea level close to the shore. And so they're doing things like building refuges where there are elevations or building elevations so that people can get warning of tsunamis and rush to those areas and be safe. And I think that is probably a lot more cost-effective sometimes than coming in after the event and trying to help people who, where already a lot of lives have been lost and their homes have been devastated.
Peter Singer, you've helped us think about how to be most effective with our charitable impulse. When it comes, we don't want to waste it by any means. And to all of our listeners, you also remind us of the joy and satisfaction in addition to the humanity and care that comes in giving. That's just terrific, too. Peter, your website is thelifeyoucansave.org. We have a link to that at our website. Listeners, if you've missed it, check it out right there. Peter Singer is author of The Life You Can Save, professor at Princeton University. Peter, thank you very much for being with us today. Wonderful to have you.
Thank you, Tom. It's been good to be with you. And thanks to all your listeners and the callers who called in who gave us a lot to think about.
Yes, they did. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.